Hello, listeners. I am here with Las Vegas Review-Journal podcast producer Reed Redmond, who is also the producer and host of Mobbed Up, The Fight for Las Vegas, an 11-part true crime podcast series produced by the Las Vegas Review-Journal in partnership with the Mob Museum, which chronicles the mob's rise and fall in Las Vegas through the eyes of those who lived it, ex-mobsters, law enforcement officials, politicians, and journalists. This is all from the podcast's landing page. It continues. From back alleys to bank vaults, dimly lit basements to the neon glow of the Las Vegas Strip, Mobbed Up will transport you to the 20th century criminal underworlds of Chicago, Kansas City, and, of course, Las Vegas. Welcome, Reed Redmond. Thank you for doing this.
Thanks for having me on. I'm excited to talk mob.
So am I, as a New Jersey native now living in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. Definitely okay. A hot topic at all times. So, the mob is kind of a big topic, even with the Mob Museum wingmanning you on the info and research side. Can you talk a little bit about how you arrived at this topic and specifically how you decided that the mob in Vegas was how you were going to try to get your arms around the topic? Like, did you come to Vegas first and decide that that was going to be blooming where you were planted? Or is this why you're in Las Vegas? Just tell me how you got here.
Sure. So as you mentioned, the mob is such a big topic that I think to make a podcast about it, you need an entry point. One example would be like Crime Town. Their first season did the mob in Providence.
Right.
Phenomenal podcast, by the way.
Yes.
And so I moved to Vegas last summer, so I'm still pretty new here. And I started with the Las Vegas Review-Journal, and we were thinking of possible podcasts that we could do. And the Mob Museum is smack dab in the middle of the downtown, so it was staring me in the face. And I was interested in the mob, and so I pitched it. And we looked around, and there was just not a lot out there in the podcast space about the mob in general, but specifically nothing about, the mob in Las Vegas and any of that storyline. So that's kind of how it came to be.
That does seem like a weird gap, given how many true crime podcasts there are just like generally that they would be thinner on the ground. What was the initial brief for the podcast? Was it a straightforward history? Was it more of an oral history? I've listened to the first two episodes, and there is a lot of talking heads material. Where is the finished product compared to what you originally conceived?
That's a good question. It sort of ended up being a balance of a documentary about the mob's rise and fall in Las Vegas and sort of a very specific, straightforward narrative about one individual, this mob associate named Frank Collada, who has just a wild story that I was actually able to sit down with for a few interviews. And so it started out as we knew we wanted to talk about the mob in Las Vegas. We knew we wanted to get as many sources on mic as we could that were actually around in Las Vegas during the 70s, during the 80s, whether right. that's investigators, journalists, things like that. And so once we started kind of looking at, who can we talk to, this story kind of came to be as, a balance of Frank's story because he's this living resource and sort of the broader picture of the mob overall.
Right. Is the whole series finished at this point and you're just waiting to push the parachutists out of the plane at this point?
It is, yeah. Yeah, I'm in that weird stage where I've spent a long time working on something and I just want people to hear it and it'll take 10 weeks.
Right. So can you walk me through what the production was like on the average episode? Just like a little inside baseball in terms of building this documentary narrative?
Yeah. So step one, before writing any of the episodes, I decided I wanted to get all of the audio that I would use for the entire series.
Right.
I ended up using 17 different interviews throughout the course of the 11 episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And some episodes are just, you know, maybe two or three of those sources on mic. Some of them are probably like 10 or 11.
Right.
And so I sort of built this mountain of audio and then went back and sort of refined my outline and structured the episodes from there, and scripted them out, looking at the audio that I had, trying to figure out how can I, you know, combine different voices from the people I've spoken to actually, you know, tell both individual stories within the episodes and then kind of get at the bigger picture over the course of the series.
Mm-hmm. So just to take a sidebar about all the audio, what was the experience of interviewing made guys? Like, what was the feeling of talking to Culotta? Like, this guy was not a bookkeeper. He's not like a tangential figure in these crimes. Like, I sat next to Michael Francesi at a press event years ago. And this is like, you know, a motivational speaker who has found religion, but also is fucking Michael Francesi. So that ozone whiff of danger was there. I know Culotta is like in his 80s now or whatever, but how were you with that in the room, I guess, for lack of a better way to put it?
At first, nervous. I that was the first time I'd spoken to someone knowing that they had taken another life. And that's a wild experience. He's not, I didn't talk to any made guys. He was an associate. The Chicago outfit had a lot less made members than the five families in New York. So he was sort of on the fringes, but he was connected to some of the big shots, was kind of his deal. So it was strange. The first time I met him, we went out and drove around Las Vegas, and he kind of gave me, he does a tour nowadays in Las Vegas. So he was kind of showing me around some of the sites. And it was weird because I knew a lot about him when I met him. And I had kind of, you know, I knew what he had done. And the person that I met didn't exactly fit what I thought he would be based on that. You know, he's a very charming guy. We, you know, talked about whatever in between talking about, you know, the crimes he's committed. We'd chat about Las Vegas and it was fun to get to know him, and I enjoyed getting to know him. So it was a strange experience.
Was there also some nervousness around, like, what if this guy is just like a non-entity on the mic? Because it can happen that people who've lived fascinating lives just like aren't good at getting it that out. So was there any apprehension about that as well?
A little bit, yeah. At the point that I started talking to Frank, we didn't know for sure that the series was going to be so focused on him.
Right.
So we were kind of keeping, you know, it ended up being compelling enough that I wanted to make, you know, a major plotline of the series about Frank. But it was a little, I mean, he's told this story before. He's written a couple of books, so I knew he'd be willing to discuss it. But there is, you know, I wasn't sure how open he would be about, you know, committing murder or about some of those things. And so it was kind of a process
open,
of...
spoiler, listeners. He's real open about it. Quite direct. Yeah.
Yeah. Very, very open. So it was kind of strange getting him to open up and getting a feel for that. And I think the first time we drove around, he was, you know, kind of giving the stock answers that he's given in other interviews and things like that. And then when I followed up and talked to him, you know, we talked a lot more about his background, his family, kind of how he came to be, you know, a career criminal, how he came to work with the mob. And I feel like I got to know him more as a person as he sort of opened up. And that was kind of an interesting process.
What was I have only heard two episodes so far. Was either of those one of the tougher episodes to put together or to break out? Like, what is the toughest episode, would you say? And what is your favorite episode? Maybe they're the same.
Ooh. I think the first couple episodes were actually the easiest for me to put together because the narrative is pretty straightforward. Mm-hmm. You know, we're only focused on one or two individuals in those ones.
Right.
Some of the later episodes get into the history of Las Vegas. The fourth episode actually like goes back to when the Las Vegas Strip first started to be built and how it originally came to be mobbed up. to throw the name of the podcast in there. And so like there's an episode where we go from 1947 Las Vegas all the way up to the 1970s. And so that's just a huge span of time to tackle. And so getting that boiled down into 40 minutes in a way that makes sense was tough. As far as my favorite episode, my favorite moment in the series is we play some wiretaps later in the series. From the Kansas City crime family. They were caught on tape kind of talking about hidden ownership of Las Vegas casinos. And that's one of the big things that contributed to the mob's downfall here. And there is a wiretap where the boss of the Kansas City crime family at the time, Nick Civella, one of his associates shows up with a copy of the Review Journal, and they just are so mad. There's a columnist in the Review Journal who's going after the mob, and the boss of the Kansas City crime family goes, "Well, the Review Journal is a dirty son of a bitch." And I can't think of a better endorsement for a newspaper than that.
That's so awesome.
I think that is my favorite episode.
So I take it that that's now your ringtone and your text alert sound, because it would be
mine. Oh, yeah. I have that 4-second soundbite cut out on my phone, and I send it to people all the time.
That is awesome. I want to get more into the nostalgia that you talk about that comes up a lot in the first two episodes. But first, I wanted to ask you about the influence or not of other mob properties on Mobbed Up. Was this a topic that you were marinating in before you moved to Las Vegas? You said before that you were interested in the mafia. So was this like Goodfellas, The Sopranos, everything Selwyn Robb ever wrote? Were you fighting those influences or were you embracing those? Like Casino looms quite large, I would say. I think most people, that's their experience of the mob in Vegas is having seen Casino on cable 10 times. So
I will admit that when I moved here, I hadn't seen Casino.
Okay.
And when I started working on this project, I made a point not to watch it all the way through until I had actually scripted most of this project. So as soon as I got through, you know, 8 or 9 of the episodes, I watched it. And it's a great movie. I had different sources saying different things about how accurate they think the portrayal is, but I sort of made a point to set aside the cultural influences like that. And because I was speaking to people who were involved in this stuff, I wanted to get at the heart of their story, what actually happened. And then, you know, as opposed to just starting at Casino and saying, how can we retell Casino or something like that?
Right. Sure. And had you, like, what about The Sopranos? Like, in terms of an episodic narrative, were there any other influences that you were sort of consciously or not trying to either include or keep at arm's length?
I wouldn't cite The Sopranos in any way. In terms of podcasts, I know I mentioned the first season of Crime Town. And that is one of the first podcasts that got me hooked on true crime, actually. And so I'm sure that was an influence in some way. I think they did just such a phenomenal job. And so maybe that was sort of when I was starting out, I looked at that and said, okay, this is kind of how they structured it. They, you know, managed to sort of tell the history of a city, but go off on different tangents, things like that. But then once I actually got going, you know, I'm not trying to rip anyone off. And so I wasn't listening to or watching anything else really about the mob when actually working on the project, sort of to just kind of keep it within its own space.
Right. So I want to get back to the nostalgia that does come up almost right away in Mobbed Up. Like I told you, I grew up in Jersey. I live in Bay Ridge. I don't know if you're familiar with Brooklyn geography. That's Saturday Night Fever land.
Okay.
But there's also a lot of retired cops and a lot of retired wise guys who live in this zip code. Maybe that can be your season 2 if you want to come out and embed at the Bay Ridge Courier. Anyway, your narration notes pretty early on that a lot of people talk about Vegas as, quote, better when it was still run by the mob. And that is something that you hear a lot in New York City, or you used to, but like everything from Atlantic City to the Javits Center to finding cheap cigarettes, people are like just from a bureaucratic standpoint, things ran more smoothly when the mob was in charge. Where do you think that nostalgia comes from in Vegas's case?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can't speak to other cities. I think in Vegas, it comes from just the coincidence of the time period when the mob was sort of running the show on the strip was a time period when Las Vegas was much, much smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And so when people look back on the mob days and think, oh, that was so much better then, I, you know, got to park for free wherever I went, which is actually something they're bringing back now as they're reopening the city. But I would get these cheap buffets, I would get comp shows, I'd get free stays. People would know my name when I walked in the door. All of that is something that people associate with the mob, but it was just a reality of Las Vegas being smaller.
Right.
And so Las Vegas has grown so much, and the gaming industry, especially here, is so big that there's no way, you know, every time you walk into a casino, you're going to be greeted by name. That's just a ridiculous expectation. And that has nothing to do with the mob being out of Vegas, except for the fact that, you know, Las Vegas being corporatized has allowed for the city to build bigger casinos, I suppose. But I think it's just people associate the mob with Las Vegas being smaller. And that's kind of at the heart of that nostalgia.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that because you do talk about that in episode one, that it was losing its small town feel. Certainly, you know, when my dad would go out there for conferences when I was a kid, which is, you know, when God was a child, it was seen as much more dangerous, but also much more parochial in a way. And going there at any time in the last 20 years, that seems like a completely different place, like literally a different place. Do you think there's also a longing for a like Sinatra mob chic? Maybe.
Yeah. And I think as time passes, people kind of put these guys on this pedestal. And you look back on someone like Tony Spilotro, who was the Chicago Outfit's reputed enforcer here. People look back on him sort of like a movie star because people just kind of treat him like Joe Pesci, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of that way with all those guys is, you know, people look back on them as Frank Sinatra types, as, you know, people they associate with the stars from back in the day. But the reality of it was, I mean, in some sense, in the day they were, you know, looked at as a weird sort of celebrity figure. But
right.
They were out here carrying out violent acts. You know, Tony Spilotro was never convicted of murder, but he was alleged to have been involved in like 24 murders.
Right.
So I think people forget, you know, the real world impact of these guys as time goes on.
Right. That it, like, everything falls away except for the charisma kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like they have fun quotes, that sort of thing, but
right.
Yeah, you don't remember what they actually did with their time.
Yeah, exactly. Like when we go to work in the morning. Right. Do you think that there's going to be, just going back to something that you said just now about as the city is reopening, do you think that there's going to be a shift generally in attitudes about like the old Las Vegas, like mid-century Wild West, narrow necktie Las Vegas in the post-COVID age? Like, do you think that that's going to sort of strengthen these feelings of nostalgia for that time, warts and all? Or like, do you think that's going to have any effect on how people see that era? Maybe only having lived there a year, you're like, I don't know what people are going to do.
Yeah, I'm still new here, but I think casinos, as they're reopening, are looking to locals more than maybe they were 4 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
As kind of as being crucial. Not that casinos ignored locals 4 months ago, but as they're reopening, there's a lot of uncertainty about whether or not people are going to feel safe traveling anywhere. And so I think as these casinos reopen, they're realizing again, you know, how important it is to have locals coming in and enjoying their casinos and everything they offer. And so, you know, we've seen casino companies start to announce that they're going to bring back free parking, at least for a period of time when they reopen, to try to get people back in the doors. So I think there will be some things like that where casinos will be trying to sort of return to that era when locals were treated, you know, really, really nicely when they'd walk in the doors. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it goes.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's the whole world right now. It's like, we don't know. I guess we'll find out.
Yeah.
I had a follow-up question about that. Well, it wasn't really about that. It's more about, it's more sort of behind the scenes sense. Also in, capital A, like with capital A, all of this going on, what is it like to send this project out into this world when you started it in the before time? Has it changed
Weird.
Anything for you in terms of like promoting it or prepping it or?
Yeah, it absolutely has. I mean, I started recording all the narration on it in our studio at the Review Journal.
Mm-hmm.
And the last six or seven episodes, I recorded all the narration in my bedroom closet.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a difference there. I'm very, very grateful that I was able to get all the interviews completed before the pandemic.
Right.
But I had to finish it up, you know, remotely. And so that was easy enough to adjust to, given that I'd had all the interviews out of the way. In terms of releasing it, we were hoping to, you know, we partnered with the Mob Museum on this, and they just have, you know, a phenomenal facility there. And so we think it, you know, it would be cool still at some point to do maybe an event or something like that to get people excited about it. But events for the time being are off the table.
Right.
So there's no way to do that. So we have shifted more towards, you know, looking at our digital resources and the Mob Museum's digital resources to try to promote this. And I think, you know, the hope is that people have time on their hands and they're, you know, swamped with all kinds of different content right now. And a lot of it is very scary. And so this is right. something that people can kind of, you know, listen to, enjoy, knock out a few hours of their day every time a couple episodes come out. That sort of thing is the hope.
Yeah. And a little history of the American West as well.
Yeah.